Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Welcome to this week's edition of Race Treaty. This week on Race Treaty, we want to focus on the International Day of the Remembrance of Slavery Victims and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. This is commemorated tomorrow, March 25th. We also want to speak on another UN celebration this week, which was the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And as I was looking for like these international protests from all of these various causes and movements to focus and converge on that day, it's pretty much a silent day as relates to the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And in part, that's what this race treaty is about. The fact that this is a international law signed and ratified by the United States, it is a human right, and white supremacy is illegal, according to international law. And yet we still embrace the civil rights, and we still seem to have some level of cognitive dissonance about the fact that we are human and have human rights possessed and outlined in legal form through the human rights laws, CERD, and the other conventions. Recently this week, I'd like to speak to this fact also. As we all know, we have this new administration coming in, and there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. But I want to bring to our audience's attention that the Republicans are moving to break from the United Nations as relates to human rights treaties. Rex Tillerson is also Secretary of State has made some comments about cutting $10 billion of U.S. funding to the United Nations. And while we have not gotten to the point of leveraging this platform as a people here in this country under the banner of human rights, we see it being eroded, not only with police killings and our women being disappeared and water being poisoned and a myriad of human rights violations. This is not seemingly accountable to its own treaties and international legal norms. And so we want to speak on that a bit tonight as well. And I'm filling in, quite frankly, for some of our other hosts, and hopefully they'll be calling in. Sister Vicky Casanova and Sister Dawati may be calling in to do some highlighting on this day commemorating tomorrow on the remembrance of slavery victims and the transatlantic slave trade. What does that mean? I mean, is that
hey, Robin, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You know what?
Hi.
I am on. Hey,
thank you.
Vicky. I am
welcome,
on,
Vicky.
But it was, thank you so much, but it's such a benefit and a blessing for us to have you to be able to introduce and frame this. So thank you so much.
Take it. Take it, sister. Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
Absolutely. Well, I literally just got back from Pittsburgh, landed, and am walking. I hope it's not too noisy. Landed and am returning from a series of meetings just with grassroots organizers as well as a few folks in the law department and sociology department, really trying to get a better handle on what it means in their case for Pittsburgh to be a human rights city, something that was passed through the efforts of some youth, working with activists within the last few years. And part of what we kept hearing while we were there for the last couple of days, sorry, I'm trying to ensure.
It's fine, that's fine.
It's noisy in my travels. What we were trying to hear, what we were hearing in the last couple of days is what you, it's exactly what you just stated, that, you know, the name only aspect is not enough. And as they look around their city, like so many of our cities and even rural areas, the promise of what it means to embrace the international human rights framework, specifically with regard to those treaties that have been adopted and ratified here in the U.S., so it's actually, you know, U.S. law as well, is just not being realized. All too often, it is disproportionately impacting people, you know, according to color, racially, also all the divisions that you noted, those people who can least afford to not be treated as human beings are the ones who are suffering. So these days that we remember and hopefully renew our commitment to make these promises real are very important.
Vicki, I'd like to I believe our host has a question, our tech man. Scotty, did you have a question?
Yes. Greetings to you, Vicki. Greetings to you, Robin, and greetings to the listeners. I have a relevant question to the International Day of Remembrance of Slavery Victims and the transatlantic slave trade. Over the past, I'd say, couple of weeks, but intermittently over the years, there are people within the black community, Afro-descendant community, who deny that the transatlantic slave trade ever happened or that we were already here as indigenous folks and they just kidnapped those people and we're not really from Africa. I would, you know, and then I even had a sister who said, well, if the transatlantic slave trade happened, where the slave ship? So I found the YouTube video when they found that ship that had sank off the coast of, I think it was off the coast of Ghana. It might have been off the coast of South Africa. And it still had those victims chained up, you know, who went down with the ship. But a lot of them escaped.
Oh, wow.
They have.
You know,
so,
Scotty, there's I came into this in understanding there were three waves from Africa. The prehistoric wave that really gives light to the fact that the oldest bones and fossils in South America are from Africa. There are different waves, and then you have the indigenous population being removed. But the southeast zone of the United States is dark folks of color. So, you know, there's this confusion stemming from our identity in that we are probably the most genetically evolved people on Earth as a species, African Americans, descendants of African Americans, the slave trade. And yet there's this cognitive dissonance even on the African side in that African Americans were rejected from the Union, African States Union. Haiti was brought in, but African Americans weren't. And you have, you know, a group of black Indians who, you know, the further away from their blackness, the more they feel their self-esteem and self-identity is elevated. And, you know, it's a problem, man, because we look at ourselves by complexion rather than DNA, quite frankly, as a marker of identity.
But my thing is, Brother Robin, is that all of those people existed. And I think part of the problem stems from when we as a community deny the existence of free black people that were here. Okay, that fought in the American Revolution, you know, just was part of colonial life here. And then so we go to the extreme that everybody, you know, got here as, you know, in the hold of a slave ship. And so, but I'm saying, how come both aren't true? Because they are both true. And so
they're
my
both
concern,
true, and we are suffering And we are all victims of the transatlantic slave trade, because that was the institutionalizing of white supremacy.
Exactly. So, there you go. So you just
no matter what, because just recently in Puerto Rico, they identified that almost all Puerto Ricans have indigenous DNA. Well, go figure. Actually, you know, probably most people of color in this hemisphere have native or indigenous DNA, as well as African or European. So, you know, there's a psychological element to this day in representing the day. For me, I always focused on the ICER day, this March 21st, as a lawfare issue, in that you have these laws in place and that the U.S. does not adhere to. And it doesn't adhere even to the framework in terms of disparate impact and disproportionality, because it doesn't aggregate the data as a requirement on a federal level. And I want to get back to Vicky, though, talking about the Human Rights City movement, because it's really going to be the key going forward, I do believe. But the approach in trying to enroll human rights into a local municipal setting can't be just based on a sentimental sanctuary city kind of premise. There's actually legal implication, as I understand, that there are three supreme laws of the land: the Constitution, the federal level, treaties, the federal level, and municipal law. And that's where the grassroots organizing could take place. And as I mentioned, I believe last week, Chicago was a precedent in that a city council can make an award and made a legal decision based on international law language, the torture in this specific case, the language of that convention. And the U.S. has been sidestepping its obligations based on something in these conventions called a reservation. So they sign and ratify, but the reservation states that...
And they exempt themselves.
Right. Well, that exemption is based on the argument that the civil rights constitutional framework protects our citizens from just discrimination. It does it to a level where they feel, and there's outlets, remedies based on proven intentionality through the civil rights legal framework, which is nonsensical also. So there's these legal sidesteps that the U.S. is doing, and all countries in this world, I do believe, have signed on for the protection of the Convention for Children, but the United States, because the United States would immediately be found culpable from the school-to-prison pipeline commodifying black bodies from youth, and it can be shown and it has been shown. And so no protection exists for the medicating of children, the vaccination of children, homeschooling
of
children.
Correct, removing them from families. You know, especially
correct.
Black
CPS is one of the most powerful state government offices, is CPS, Child Protection Services, you know, sworn to dismantle families under the guise of protecting them. And so
Yes. We
haven't been able to find a way on a local level to enact ordinances, not just the sentimental "we are a human rights city" declaration, but actual laws that will encompass, based on human rights language that the U.S. has signed on to, that we want to enforce this where we live as humans under the human rights banner. So that in itself is a major component, I think, of the Human Rights City movement, is identifying how we can insert ordinances and laws on a local level to protect us based on human rights. And Vicky, I would love you to hear your response to this and how that could come about.
Yes, no, I agree with you completely. And we literally are beginning this conversation. So it's part of what you have highlighted, is that there is a great need for collaboration, for exchanging ideas, and, you know, brainstorming with intentionality, that this not just be something sentimental, you know, and in name only, but also part of why we were meeting with folks in a city that is already taken the step of, at the city council level, you know, taking on that banner of a human rights city. One of the things, and there are five, Pittsburgh was the fifth, I guess there actually are a couple more since that time. One of the things I've noted is that it seems to be quite a bit easier for cities and municipalities which have a higher, how should I say this, it's a little bit more challenging when cities are majority Black, majority poor, and literally have issues that they're going to have to grapple with from a human rights perspective than it seems to have been for some others, Eugene, Oregon, Mountain View, and some other places. Mm-hmm. We're not deterred, but we just have to be very clear that this is something that cannot happen in a vacuum. We do need to exchange ideas and share information. And one of the key learnings from just the last couple of days in Pittsburgh, but also from last weekend, you got to hear from some of the street law corps, peer educators, and first offenders who are working in Chicago, and they stopped to both commemorate but also to meet with people at important locations where human rights violations have occurred, like Memphis, Tennessee, with Dr. King's, the Lorraine Motel and all that has happened there with the National Civil Rights Museum, hallowed ground, Jackson, Mississippi, with the self-determination from the Republic of New Africa, the work that's happening with Cooperation Jackson and the Jackson Human Rights Institute today. They have a human rights charter, but they're not yet officially a human rights city. And so exchanging those ideas and going on to Baton Rouge, right, to speak with people who were dealing still with the aftermath of the Alton Sterling killing, which was all about economics. That's it, right? How dare he be able to sell CDs outside a store with the merchant being totally comfortable with him doing it, and the government not be able to tax him on that? How dare you? So we just know that there are some really basic threads that run through this, and part of what needs to continue to happen is education, just like what happens here on Race Treaty, for people to begin to even understand the meaning behind those words, human rights, right? And you're everybody's right. Coming in at a different level.
I'm kind of focused on the legal aspect of the conventions and trying to understand specifically ICER, the International Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. And in that language, it speaks to disparate impact. And I freeze frame that word. The disparate impact speaks to a victim. Immediately, there cannot be impact unless there's a victim, obviously, that's receiving that impact. And there's victims' rights attached to that language as well. And the disproportionality is obviously a data, a collection process, but disparate impact actually speaks to a condition. And there's a right involved there from a victim standpoint of to white supremacy and discrimination. And, we don't have the remedy in the civil rights framework. And, I wanted to speak to this also in that when is this bridge going to happen between the industry, I call it, of civil rights transcending into human rights? How can that industry redirect its focus under the international legal frameworks rather than just be fixated in the limited intentionality framework of civil rights related to what housing and employment primarily, rather than all the areas of people activity that we're affected by white supremacy and all areas of our living we're affected. And there's data of that effect and there's impact from that effect in all areas of people activity. Yet we've allowed ourselves to be limited in scope as to how we even see civil rights and anti-discrimination legislation. So human rights in the international law really does present the most intersectional and inclusive language. And what I've noticed in observing activities of groups that are leaning on human rights is the LGBT community and female reproduction, which I'm not questioning that. But what I do question is why isn't Black Lives Matter, the issue of police killings, the issues of education, water, why aren't these being pushed in the human rights arena? And if we can't rely on the federal government, notwithstanding the state barriers to accessing that, why can't we begin a legal process based on a model on a municipal level? I mean, that to me seems to be the most our grassroots location and our best hope in being proactive for change legally would happen in the municipal realm. And so I'm kind of begging right. that question as to the human rights campaign and the city's definition. How do we set that up and empower
I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I hear you 100%. And that's really, really, really crucial. So part of that, again, is exchanging ideas, sharing information, and knowing that, for example, you mentioned the partial reparations when in Chicago with regard to being the first entity, city, or any other mm-hmm. municipality right. to ever win any form of reparation for police brutality, in this case, right. torture. And that came through, it was more than 10 years, actually, of a 40-year fight, the last 10 years of which we were internationalizing this, again, through mm-hmm. The leadership of Attorney Stan Willis and a grassroots group, Black People Against Police Torture, and allies and comrades. So 10 years it took to begin educating not just individuals at the grassroots level, not just the people, but our elected officials. To the extent that judges would begin to incorporate in their judgments and their language mm-hmm. from the concluding observation
wow.
of the CAT and the CERT and the UPR, mm-hmm. which were a result of our filing stakeholders reports elevating the offenses and the brutality. It came from young people, college age, traveling to Geneva, Switzerland, to learn that process and not even testify, but to stand silently with fists in the air and T-shirts on with the face of their friend who died because he was tased while running, hit his head in, on a light pole. He should never have been tased while running for some minor infraction. So it's a process of, at every level, helping educate and inform people with the details that we have researched, we the people, to help them understand the human rights law, which is bigger, as you're saying, from versus the civil rights law. So they began to play that back to us, and city council would make statements that made it very, very clear that they were hearing that there's a new law of the land. The human rights framework yeah. is beginning to be infused in that way. And if we can do it in Chicago and, or in Pittsburgh or in Jackson, Mississippi, or we can do it everywhere. We just have to continue to communicate along those lines. I want to say something quickly about the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. As we continue to lift up the decade, right, and mm-hmm. tomorrow, this International Day of Remembrance of Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, because we do know that it's not just the Holocaust of African enslavement that this Day of Remembrance is about, but, that's really what we're speaking to in large part today. Mm-hmm. But that we did bring in when we hosted the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent here in Chicago, for example, a year ago, this past January, there was five cities, and I'm thinking Jackson, Baltimore, New York, D.C., and Chicago. And we treated our Chicago tribunals, really, a people's assembly, as a regional hearing opportunity for those couple of days. We only had them for about 3 hours total. The powers that be cut into the grassroots civil society's time right. the second day and held them up for about an hour. But what they did hear from people from Michigan, from Detroit, from Flint with regard to that water issue. So, but I hear you saying, too, we need to utilize the instruments. We need to continue to not just do the two-minute testimonies when and where we can, whether here on U.S. soil or in Geneva or in D.C. at the Organization of American States, which they are really kind of defunding and looking to shut down. But we have to use all of those tools and layer the human rights, just double down on it.
Correct. I quickly speaking to Michigan and Flint, I'm reminded that it actually initiated in Detroit when the Canadian human rights groups approached the United Nations about the human rights violations concerning the water. And they did it representing Detroit's situation because we don't have an infrastructure for a human rights network around the country. We don't have that infrastructure set up and established for human rights. And so Canada actually initiated that complaint to the UN and Detroit, and then subsequently Flint circumstances kind of lent some light to that. And I have another question, though, as relates to human rights. I want to introduce you to a gentleman. His name is Dan Buford, Reverend Dan Buford. He's been a guest on our show. Reverend Buford went to, Belgium, where there was the World Court after Katrina. And he presented there in such a language that was adopted thereafter concerning the Katrina and human rights. Dr. Buford since then has compiled all of the police killings of black youth under 18 going back quite a few generations. And what he then attempted to do was bring that under the banner of the children, a protection of children, because the United States has not signed that treaty and doesn't adhere to children's rights. And he right now is going around the country really organizing around the police killings. And I think there's a movie documentary that's going to be produced from producers from Italy concerning these police killings from the mother's perspective. And the subsequent family's reaction to the loss based on this ongoing killings by authorities. But Dan Buford has compiled, and he's been presented to the United Nations World Courts, and he's trying to develop a legal strategy, and he's not a lawyer, but he's well on his way, and he needs that support in terms of navigating the U.S. laws to get out of here and actually land in the United Nations with our claims and our issues in world courts. And you mentioned the courts dealing with the United States. But we're really hard pressed to access that unless we maybe were able to do it with claims coming from a municipal voice. As opposed to individuals are very limited. And as we rely on civil society, they really participate in the UN activities and the working groups. But where is our teeth in terms of enforcement? Very, very difficult issue as I see it. And I think that's what maybe takes some of the motivation and inspiration of around a lot of the activists that I know, that the UN is like going backwards and we don't have teeth. We don't have a way of enforcement, even though the violations are there. So I'm really looking to the grassroots level, and you are a leader in this country as it relates to this human rights cities movement. And I do believe it's our next platform, and we do need to do the information exchange and find a model that we all can duplicate. And that is one of the things that I wanted to, you know, talk on about the importance of the state of black, whatever city, but here in Asheville, having taken data from all these areas of peakable activity, it is what we need as a report for every organizing effort for each city, I think. And I'm going to back off, but I wanted to spill that so that maybe as a follow-up, Vicki, we can have this dialogue in another race treaty episode.
Definitely. I would love to do that. And please do not back off. What we know is that remembrance, right, in the spirit of how you started the show this evening, remembrance of the Holocaust of slavery or, you know, African enslavement, for example, does not just mean looking back and being sentimental. It also means how do we help ensure that those that intent, right, to at genocide is not the end of the story. And so to that end, it's totally appropriate that you are raising, you know, the what next, the next steps and the what ifs and the solution, because we know that we're still living the ongoing impact of enslavement. So that really is, you know, as we're such resilient people. It can be very, I know there are generations that just didn't want to look back. They didn't want to feel the pain, you know, the ongoing trauma. But mm-hmm. it is important to acknowledge and to name the root causes intentional of a lot of the state that we're in, because it makes it really, really clear that this is literally a result of denying people's humanity. And we're not going to just allow that to happen. Too many people have fought and died. You know, as you talked about, you know, Scotty, the bones, right? So I'm gonna kind of remind you of some of the folks we got to hear from last week who were talking about being able to touch bases with activists and organizers, including some of the families of people who had been killed, you know, just shot down, just murdered by police. Mm-hmm. And we stopped in Baton Rouge. We spent some time in Ferguson, you know, on the way back. And mm-hmm. and yet our time in between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, there are a ton of plantations. And one of the time, what part of where we spent our time was just at one called Whitney Plantation. And interestingly, one of the community members that we met with later, you know, a friend of mine who's an educator and an organizer in New Orleans, had pointed out to folks, he said, you know, that's just one kind of museum turned into what is supposed to have the African descendant perspective more so than some have in the past, which has kind of been turned into another form of money making off of our people's mm-hmm. enslavement. But this one, he felt, in knowing the owners, that it was a better step in the right direction of really shining a light and from the African descendant's perspective on what literally where some of our people's blood, sweat, and tears you know, still it is embedded in the soil and the air and the spirits and all. But he said, you know, did you all notice, he said to the young folks I had with me, did you all notice the one across the way, the signs, it said Angola? And one said, yeah. And he said, does that ring a bell to anybody? You all work with law enforcement accountability. And one of them said, oh, yeah, we heard about Angola prison. And he said, exactly. So, to make a long story short, for those people who have even seen the movie 13th recently, right, as we're talking again about our Constitution and some of these legal instruments, and they know that slavery is not outlawed in this country, the 13th Amendment still protects that intent that white supremacy and white privilege is specifically on the backs of black bodies for monetary gain. And he noted that Angola prison actually includes a lot of folks who are doing, you know, slave labor today, and that some of them are still picking cotton. You know, it was just amazing for some of these young organizers from the North and the Midwest to really be able to see the real landscape of what they've maybe read a little bit about, and then we kind of move on. You know, you get like 2 days of Black history, if that, in many cities and schools, and it doesn't accurately reflect our history because we were not hatched in slavery. You know, but as we look at it, they were just stunned to connect the dots, standing there on this ground, to realize that centuries and generations later, the same activity is taking place to benefit the same systems of oppression and the same financial barons mm-hmm. at the cost and expense of the same people. You talk about disparate impact. So that helps, again, to make, in the midst of all this chaos and all these smoke screens and all these emergencies, you know, that we're these fires that continue to come up with the new administration here in our nation state, that long game that others are playing, that the opposition is playing, is still rolling forward, and we've got to be as strategic and as unified. And the human rights frame offers us the focus that we need to have.
Absolutely.
So I thank you for mentioning the name of Dan Buford, because, again, we do need to connect. I will also say something about a growing network, to your point about the need to network, and that is the U.S. Human Rights Network. You can Google U.S. or our listeners can Google USHRnetwork.org, and it is really the focus of this network to become a to really help build a people-centered human rights movement. So it's not a framework or infrastructure that is going to direct you to a somebody that you need to follow or some existing organization. It truly is a coordinating center and a body, and it is a network of grassroots individuals and organizations, some of them very large, of course, ACLU, and some others are very deeply involved, but there are others who are, two and three people literally trying to figure out how to apply the human rights knowledge and legal frame to our benefit in many cases, regardless of whether, and, every single approach, every win, and every, delay, because we don't see defeats. We may see delays, but that's a learning experience as well. The network gives us the opportunity to share and exchange that information so we're not reinventing the wheel. And that's just crucial. So I really urge people to take a really good, hard look at the U.S. Human Rights Network and even the website. And perhaps we should be including some of the podcasts from Race Treaty on Black Talk Radio Network, even there. I think they would be very open to that, because it really is about amplifying the knowledge that each of us has as we try to really, really ratchet up our effectiveness in applying the human rights remedies.
Yes, the Human Rights Network is the big game in town. We really need to support it. I was involved in the CERT Task Force Shadow Report that was developed by Dr. Randall with DAIS, Descendants.
Yes.
I want to speak to one thing before we go. Scotty, Vicky, the word remembrance brings to mind that actually new scientific data has confirmed that trauma is passed intergenerationally through DNA. And so we can't escape our ancestors in recognizing in the remembrance. It echoes within us and our ability to adapt in this white supremacy framework. But we are all impacted, and we carry the weight of our ancestors, and this remembrance of that transatlantic slave trade speaks to so many things. It speaks to the existence of corporations. It speaks to capitalism. It speaks to white supremacy. It speaks to the sophistication of law that excludes others as humans. And it's the memory of the brings us to the point we're at right now, and that is that we're living under an oppressive regime called white supremacy, and we're seeking escape for our freedom. And as you have reiterated, human rights is what we need to embrace and stand on, not necessarily defined by others, but be defined by ourselves. And that opportunity is there over this decade. And there are many, many workers such as yourself, Vicky, Anaji, Scotty, across the board. And we have yet to culminate, in this human rights campaign and movement. And I think that's going to be really initiated and sparked by the cities such as Jackson, Pittsburgh, Chicago, up and coming, and Seattle as models for transformation to recapture our human rights. But the remembrance is really based on the ancestral. We don't speak spiritually or metaphysically so much oftentimes, but that's really a vital part of who we are and our identity also. So we do carry those spiritual scars of remembrance, like it or not.
Definitely. We do. And we also carry those spiritual strengths, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it's just, well, let me just say this simply. One of the things that we hope to do in even tomorrow, but certainly in future years as we continue this human rights education process, is to commemorate in a, you know, more proactively and more actively, for example, a virtual day of action. It's very easily accomplished in this era of technology and social media. So we thank you for taking the time out, you know, to Race Treaty this evening to help share the information for people that never heard of the International Day of Remembrance, right, for slavery and victims of the transatlantic slave trade.
Wow,
but
right.
One thing that people can do is, you know, tweets and information on Facebook. Google it. There's a whole calendar. There are events that are happening tomorrow in locations actually around the world, mm-hmm. where they have perhaps, whether it's child slavery, whether it's, you know, people being trafficked, there are all kinds of things, as well as African descendants commemorating the Maafa. So you know, it doesn't take a lot for folks to, you know, as a part of remembering, to even, you know, have a moment of silence or to read a book to a young person, to a little one that is age appropriate, but still helps us. A button that I purchased just as a souvenir, they were $1, right? For the organizers that intergenerationally that were traveling on this really cultural exchange from up south to down south last weekend, and you all will recognize these words. It said, "Lest we forget," right? Also, some of the video learning and some of the books that were there in this teaching tour that's available at, in this case, the Whitney Plantation. And I'm not trying to advertise for them. I just want to share with people that, you know, that was one that I personally felt good about, because the tour guide was an African descendant, but also had some very insightful perspective and feedback that I think can help an experience like that be less traumatizing for people who really want to go and to learn, but don't want to have trauma upon trauma by feeling that they're not hearing it in the way or from the person that they want to hear it from. So I'll just leave that there. But what I wanted to say is that they have a small bookstore, and they also had some snippets of recordings that people could listen to from the slave narratives that were, you know, a part of the, I guess, WPA, you know, back decades ago, to capture some of their own words and sentiments, and remembering the words of people who were living at that time who had just gone through hell on earth, and their, you know, remarks, statements like, "Don't forget my chains," right? So that remembrance, even then, as they were looking forward to knowing that their lives would end, but that they were enduring for us, that they had not even met yet. We hadn't been born, even, some of them. So this remembering is more than just, you know, it's important. It's powerful. It's
very
important.
Very important. I want to highlight the fact that there are those that have not let the word slavery be referred to some past tense time. It's active now. And Scotty and the abolition movement with Max Parthas has been really on the forefront of making sure that that narrative continues full of information. And they've organized, there's a Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March this August. Yes, and so that's going to highlight the fact that, yes, slavery still exists. We have a remembrance of the transatlantic slave trade, and in that memory, we should recognize our present circumstances as relates to that. And it's ongoing, as you said. And there are those, and there's going to be a major national movement on D.C. August 19th, Millions for Prisoners, Human Rights. Because indeed, we've been commodified from youth to be just that, just an inanimate object for value to those that have engaged in this private prison system, which requires that so many beds be filled by contract. That is a total dehumanizing process. And we know it for what it is, slavery. And I'd like actually Scotty to speak on that real quick before we head out of here tonight. Scotty?
Yes, I'm sorry, I forget the lady's name who organized it, who's the actual lead organizer. But if the listening audience would just simply Google Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, that's the best way to get to the page that's on her website, because she runs a organization, a nonprofit here in North Carolina, for prisoner services. And so Crystal Wright, I believe is her name. I know her first name's Crystal, but I think it's Crystal Wright. So if you Google that, she's the lead organizer. I'm on the panel of speakers as we try to spread the word about the march that'll take place on August 19th, 2017, and converging on Washington, D.C., trying to get different organizations to come on and endorse it, sign on, whatever you can do, send a delegation. When we say millions, like Max said, we really need millions. And while it is highlighting the need for human rights for people in prison, we call it prison slavery. So this is part of a new abolitionist movement. And as Vicky was speaking, I was like, well, you know, if we need a day of remembrance, I mean, what a great day, you know, for that. To while we're highlighting modern day slavery, also, let's have a moment of silence for the past victims of slavery. So I think that will be a good day for people to collaborate on.
Well, I think this is wonderful. Thank you so much, Scotty. And I do want to share that there's something tomorrow that we will be doing, some of us in Chicago, participating in an overall event, which is the African Youth Forum. This is hosted annually. This might be the sixth annual, maybe the seventh, by an organization called the United African Organization, UAO. And what the UAO has done in Chicago is really help provide a network and a collective that has really helped unify, I've observed in the just the last few years, a very large but fragmented, you know, group of African nationals from a range of countries in Africa here in the U.S. I'm sorry, here in Chicago specifically. And they do a really great job, you know, looking at a lot of human rights issues, quite frankly, although just beginning to look at it, utilizing that nomenclature and that focus. But they definitely have been in the forefront of some of the, we call it crimmigration, the criminalization of immigrant status, many of these immigrants being African nationals, many being, you know, Muslim. And so they're catching it across all different levels. They're not born in this country. In many cases, they are black. They are speaking a different language and often are Muslim. So it was found that they've had some of the invisible impacts that, you know, other people are seeing as a huge threat to the human rights for immigrants. Vicky. And I just, so as part of their whole day of education around and events around their African Youth Forum, they've carved out a part of that day to be focused on this International Day of Remembrance, since it's falling this year on that actual day, which is awesome. And what I will do, Scotty, thank you for raising that. I will also, as a part of that commemoration tomorrow, which is looking back, I will make sure that we share the information about that slavery continues and that this million, this is amazing. Tell us the title of that again
it
on
is,
August 19th.
It is Millions for Prisoners Human Rights. So okay. We got to have our human rights organizations representing, you know, and I would also like to say, though, slavery present, I like to call it post-1865 slavery, after the 13th, slavery should unite all groups across socioeconomic, ethnic lines, because you, as you would just mention, the immigrant population, which are the primary, make up the bulk of those who are in private facilities, in private prisons, and they just filed a lawsuit actually charging these organizations, suing them for slavery. This is in their lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They're saying it's slavery. It violates certain federal laws that prevent human trafficking. And so, you know, when we say millions, you know, while we do in terms of, since we, this is our platform and we speak mostly to the issues of our community, but I just want people to recognize as an individual, I recognize slavery, period. I don't want anyone to become a victim of slavery. And so while we had a status of being, you know, affected by this institution for 400 years, since, like Robin said, they used it to introduce white supremacy, well, post-1865, there may be some Latino people, Hispanic people, indigenous people who have an ancestor who was in slavery. I tell people about my little brother who they had working on a turkey farm for less than $1 an hour, who was wrongfully convicted with no evidence, saying he broke in the house and stole property, convicted by an all right jury. He was 10 years a slave. You know, we hear about the narrative of 12 years a slave. It's a lot of us with our own slaves narratives to tell. Modern slave narratives.
That's right. I have a white supremacy insight also about the system. Up until this recent, the category of white by the U.S. Census Bureau included Middle East, North Africans, and Arabs. And since this Trump immigration thing, they've now moved to recategorize the North Africans and Arabs from being white in the United States. And so there's a ongoing identification as how they move our identities around and change colors and designations for their own oppressive ends. And so that was an irony, because a few years ago I had posted about a brother from, I think, Morocco or Algeria that came to U.S. and they designated him as white, and he fought that. Well, no longer. The U.S. Census Bureau now defines white as a person living from the regions of Europe, the Middle East, or North Africa, and that's about to change. And so that was kind of an insight on white supremacy, how they can ebb and flow that identity for purposes of numbers, economics, and oppression. And while the white Latinos are integrating into whiteness, the indigenous dominated Latinos are being oppressed with this whole immigration process. And as the sister mentioned, there's as many Africans that are being oppressed, and they're trying to escape the U.S. to get to Canada, in fact.
Right.
Yeah. So white supremacy is morphs, and it's continuing to morph. And it's going to go into darkness in terms of how it's morphing, because we're not going to have that UN eye on our human rights. U.S. is trying to withdraw finances. They're trying to withdraw, and Israel's along with them. And it all goes back to the first UN conference on racism in Durban, where U.S. and Israel walked out, where they're attempting to define racism, where they can actually codify that language as to what it is, white supremacy, and make it actually really with teeth illegal. And U.S. and Israel quickly sidestepped that and redefined racism with anti-Semitism and all that nonsense there. And so we're right back at square one in the decade, our second or third year into the decade. And I have
second
a lot of
year.
Expectations. Yeah, we need some benchmarks. We need some progress reports. We don't need the lamentation and celebrations. We need some proactive plans to undo a white supremacy. And with that note, we're at the end of the show this evening, Vicky. And I'm so appreciative of you coming in, taking your time, walking out of the airport, hosting a show mobile as you walk.
Much respect.
And as always, Scotty, much respect, brother. Thank you for joining Race Treaty. Until next week, we're signing off. Peace, y'all.
Peace.